Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in the listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messer, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Kath, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Diverse Populations Living with Multiple Myeloma, and this is part three of Living with Multiple Myeloma. And today's program is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I'd like to do a few things. First of all, I'd like to let you know there's over 100 participants on this call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from the Philippines, Saudi Arabia, Uganda, and United Kingdom. So truly, this is a global call, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Craig Emmett Cole, and Dr. Cole is with the Karmanos Cancer Institute, Associate Professor of Medicine, Wayne State University School of Medicine, Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine, Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. And Dr. Cole will be addressing an overview of diverse populations living with multiple myeloma, how race may impact your access to the treatment of multiple myeloma, current standard of care, new and emerging treatments, reducing complications of bone disease and the role of transplantation, and preventing and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Cole.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about myeloma, the disease that I have really dedicated my life to. To kind of level set, myeloma is a cancer of the plasma cells that live inside the bone marrow of the body. And we know that all patients that have myeloma at some point had a precursor disease called monoclonal gammopathy of uncertain significance, or MGUS. And that the vast majority of people that have MGUS, which is about 8% of people over age 50, the vast majority will never develop myeloma. But for reasons that we're not quite clear on, but we're getting better clarity to, that some patients with MGUS will develop myeloma. The cancer of the plasma cells, where it can cause bone destruction, anemia, kidney damage, bone pain, and sometimes high calcium levels. The one unique thing that is that we find in myeloma that we don't see in a lot of other diseases is that it's more prevalent and the incidence is higher in people of African descent. And that's African descent around the world, just not in the United States. And in the United States specifically, the incidence for men is about 17.1 per 100,000, and for women, 13 per 100,000, as compared to all other, compared to all races, where instead of being 17, it's 8 for men, and instead of being 13, it's 5 for all races. So there's a huge difference in the incidence of this disease. And around the world, and so it's not. We've looked for years, and it's not related to chemical exposures that we know of. It's not related to. It might be related to obesity, but it's not related to socioeconomic status, income, again, exposure. So we have had a real hard time explaining the racial difference in the incidence of myeloma. The one thing that we do know is that when patients, Black patients, Latino patients, and all patients, when people have equal access to care, that that Black patients tend to do the same, if not a little bit better, than their white counterparts. And we do know that that myeloma biologically is a little bit different than other than people than myeloma found in European descended individuals, in the way that Black patients that have myeloma have less of a mutational burden. They have lower incidences of the high risk, difficult to treat cytogenetics, that Black patients will present with higher calcium levels, more kidney damage, and more anemia than their white counterparts, and that they're more likely to have myeloma disease outside the bones. The one reason that we do know that has that higher incidence is that there's a higher incidence of the precursor disease in Black populations, so 6 times higher than in white counterparts. The standard of care that I had mentioned currently for myeloma is a antibody against myeloma called daratumumab, and 3 drugs that we've used for quite some time in the treatment of myeloma. An immunomodulatory drug called lenalidomide or Revlimid, a proteasome inhibitor called Velcade or Bortezomib, and we use and have used for decades dexamethasone or steroids. Those three drugs together, those 4 drugs together, along with a bone strengthener known as Zometa or zoledronic acid, have response rates that are very high, very high. In fact, the highest that we've seen in the history of this disease, in the way of 80 to 90% response rates, with many of those patients going into very good partial remissions or complete remissions. And so it's very good news. The problem is that that all things aren't equal in this world, and that we know that Black patients are twice as more likely to have delays in myeloma diagnosis. They wait about 2 to 3 times longer to initiate novel therapy for myeloma drugs. That Black patients will typically wait about 5.5 months, while white patients will only wait 2.5 months. They're less likely to be included in clinical trials, we'll talk about in a bit. But biologically, the disease in Black patients is easier to treat. The other thing that we use when we treat patients with myeloma is those patients that are eligible for it. We do high dose chemotherapy and stem cell transplantation. What that does is that, and I always describe to my patients, is that when we're treating myeloma, we're using, and I don't know much about boxing, to be honest with you, but we're like using, a right hook to beat down the myeloma, and the chemotherapy from the transplant is like a left upper hook, which will knock the disease out. The disease is not expecting that dose of chemotherapy, and to make that chemotherapy safe, we have harvest the stem cells that will grow back into bone marrow. We give the dose of chemotherapy, give your stem cells back, so patients are in the hospital for only 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and that really does help to reduce the myeloma burden in patients. And then we follow that with a maintenance therapy, usually including some of the drugs that we use with the induction therapy. And really, because patients go into the responses so quickly when given therapy, their pain is usually addressed fairly rapidly, because people respond so quickly. And it's really important that we give the bone strengthener. So the hallmark of myeloma is that it goes to the bone. The multiple, meaning multiple bone lesions, and myeloma, meaning from the marrow. And so this disease is defined by bone lesions. And one way that we also, not only treating disease, does that help the pain, but also using a bone strengthener. We do know that Black and Latino patients are less likely to receive some of the bone strengtheners to treat myeloma and will have delays in receiving the bone therapies. You know, why do all of these disparities exist? Is because the fact that myeloma is a fairly complex disease to treat, and I think that we are really struggling with being able to provide information to general oncologists about how best to treat this disease. We write guidelines of how to treat the disease, but the problem is, which is kind of a good problem, is that the standard of care keeps changing. The clinical trials keep giving us better and better therapies. The four-drug regimen I just talked about is fairly new. And so it's really hard to keep up with myeloma for general oncologists because the standard of care just keeps improving. And because it's relatively rare compared to colon cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer, it's hard for general oncologists to keep up, which is why patients that are of higher socioeconomic status, patients that are associated with myeloma centers do better because they have providers that are able to, that are more caught up with the changes and improvements in this disease. We also know that Black and Latino and Asian patients have been underrepresented in the clinical trials that are the basis of all these new therapies for myeloma. That the reason that we have these fantastic, therapies that have, 80 to 90% response rates are because of clinical trials. How do we know how to treat myeloma and treat relapsed myeloma is because of clinical trials. And even though in the United States, 20% of Black, 20% of all myeloma patients are Black, they typically only represent 4 to 5% of patients involved in clinical trials, with 12%, with there being a 10% to 12% of Latino patients involved in clinical trials, again, less than 5%, of the total number of myeloma patients, 10% Latino of all myeloma patients in the United States, they'll represent 5% involved in clinical trials. And so it's really important for everyone to be involved in clinical trials so that we make sure when we treat this disease that the treatments work equally for everyone. And when we finally find a cure for myeloma, that it, again, that everyone has access to it. The final thing to mention is that myeloma is not curable, but is controllable in many cases. And that, with most patients that have myeloma, at some point the myeloma will relapse, and that's where the really new therapies have really shown through. And particularly, the using T cell redirection therapies, where we get the T cells are the cells in your body that destroy mutated cells and cancer cells. When patients have myeloma, their T cells are unable to find their myeloma cells. And so these T cell redirection therapies help to redirect the T cells that have been ignoring the cancer to destroy the cancer. And they have remarkable response rates for everyone. The Black, White, and Latino patients have very good response rates, but they do have different side effects. That Black patients are more likely to have side effects from some of these T cell redirection therapies, which is why, again, it's so important to be involved in clinical trials. And how do you prevent and manage side effects and symptoms With myeloma, it really is important to communicate to your doctor when you have side effects. We know, and this, including side effects in a way of financial problems that can come with myeloma, because these medications are very expensive. So communicating the side effects, because we have solutions for most of the side effects. I've had patients that have had terrible diarrhea from some of the medications, but they don't want to tell me. And I can fix it and alleviate that when patients are empowered and feel that they can communicate the side effects to me. And so if patients have pain, if patients have any side effects from the drugs, if they have rashes, that is really important to communicate to the doctor and the healthcare team, because there are solutions for all of those things. And I think that addresses all the points.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Cole. That was just a stellar, a superb presentation. And since you are the first speaker, you really set the tone for today's program, and I really want to thank you for doing that. And I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so very much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Maria Chi, and Dr. Chi is an oncology social worker. And she's a clinical oncology social worker, author, and researcher in healthcare disparities, social determinants of health, psychosocial oncology, and financial toxicity. And she will be addressing how to find the best care team, social determinants of health, including languages spoken and health literacy, and food insecurity and food deserts, tips to increase your access to health-promoting nutrition. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chi.
Finding a healthcare or treatment team is so fundamental to your cancer experience because you'll likely be spending much of your time with them for this period in your life. They'll get to know you quite well, and it's important that you feel comfortable, seen, and heard by the people who have such a big role in your life. After your initial diagnosis, you may automatically receive a referral from the doctor who diagnosed you. Another place to start is to ask your PCP or primary care physician for a referral to an oncology specialist within your insurance network. Checking with your health insurance company is another important initial step, as they should be able to send you a list of oncologists on their insurance panel, meaning those doctors and hospitals or treatment centers whose services they'll pay for. You may even reach out to friends and family who have experienced cancer for their recommendations. Don't be afraid to consult with more than one provider or treatment center, as you're entitled to a second or third opinion, which can be very valuable in determining the course of your treatment. You may seek an opinion at an NCI or National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer center, which tend to excel in cancer research and treatment. But no matter where you decide to seek care, make sure the physician specializes in your particular type of cancer. A helpful question to ask them is, how many people with my type of cancer have you treated? Do you tend to approach cancer care more cautiously or more aggressively with a standard treatment protocol or a clinical trial, if those are available to me or apply to my situation? You'll also want to pay attention to potential providers' communication style, or what we commonly call their bedside manner. Are they listening to you carefully, answering your questions, asking you about your preferences within the scope of treatment options available to you? Are they taking any cultural or personal concerns or considerations seriously? How do they respond to you asking them questions? And if your treatment is going to be more than chemotherapy, immunotherapy, or targeted treatment, your team may also include a surgeon or a radiation oncologist. From a more holistic perspective, your healthcare team also encompasses nurses, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, medical assistants, social workers, et cetera. One question to consider is, what is the availability of these other types of providers and other support services for both emotional and practical resources at this treatment center? Zooming out a little bit more to consider an even more holistic perspective, let's talk about some of the factors in your daily surroundings that may also impact your care, such as social determinants of health. Social determinants of health are conditions in our environment that affect our quality of life and health outcomes, both our risk of getting certain diseases and how well we do with them once we get them. And there are five main types of social determinants of health. One is economic factors, such as our access to job opportunities, our neighborhood, including our immediate environment and access to clean water, nutritious food, housing and transportation, our social and community factors like exposure to structural inequalities, discrimination or disparities, versus our opportunities to participate in meaningful social activities, healthcare factors, including our access to doctors, hospitals, and places for physical activity or exercise, and then finally, educational factors, our access to quality schools, libraries, and reading materials in our primary language, and our community's literacy rates, including health literacy. In particular, having access to medical information in our primary language affects our ability to request, understand, or even participate in our medical care. Language barriers may lead to miscommunication between patients and healthcare providers, which can affect the quality and safety of our care. Health literacy is the degree to which we can find, understand, and use health-related information to make our healthcare decisions. Our hospitals and treatment centers have a responsibility to ensure access to material and services that we can actually use. For example, are there pamphlets and brochures or information on their websites at a level that most of us can understand without too much jargon or confusing explanations? And then are they offered in our preferred language? One thing you can do on a personal level is to advocate for yourself. Ask your providers if your clinic has an interpreter service, either in person or by phone, that may facilitate your visit. And referring back to another type of social determinant of health, the availability of nutritious, safe, and affordable food and groceries in your neighborhood. Not having consistent access to these things is considered food insecurity, which in turn can make chronic health problems worse. Food insecurity affects approximately 41 million Americans. And related to food insecurity are our so-called food deserts. Basically, these are neighborhoods with very few grocery stores or markets where you may have to travel a long way to reach them. This is technically more than half a mile in cities and more than 10 miles in more rural areas. And if you're homebound, have mobility issues, or are immunocompromised from your cancer or treatment, this can make access to grocery stores even more of a barrier. There are some programs that can help reduce this barrier, things like Meals on Wheels, SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, food banks, local religious organizations, and mutual aid societies. You may even ask the social worker or patient navigator in your hospital or treatment center if there is a local nonprofit organization that offers a free meal delivery service for people undergoing cancer treatment. These do exist in some areas. Equally important is to consult with an oncology nutritionist or registered dietitian about maximizing the quality and nutritional value of the food available to you, especially in conjunction with your cancer care. All of these things underscore why choosing your health team, your care team, is so important for your overall cancer experience. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Chi. That was just a superb presentation. Just stellar and a lot of information for our participants to understand how important that is. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and she is an oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and she'll be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian and nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are fundamental in providing your body what it needs in order to function. The question a lot of patients have is, what should I eat or what should I avoid while I'm getting my cancer treatment? The answer to that question is going to be individualized based on your treatment plan, any comorbidities that you have, your level of nourishment, just to name a few. However, in general, a whole food, plant-based diet is where about two-thirds of your plate is covered with a plant-based food, such as fruit, veggies, grains, beans, peas, lentils, nuts, and seeds. And the other third is a lean protein source, such as a wild-caught fish, a white meat, poultry, lean red meats. You can occasionally even bring in a plant-based protein such as beans, peas, or lentils. The plant-based foods provide your body with antioxidants, phytochemicals, fiber, and the lean proteins provide your body with the building blocks to help your body repair, building tissues, muscles, and repairing any other maybe wounds or issues that you may be dealing with. The key to a whole foods plant-based diet is to get foods that look like they did when they were first harvested. So, you know, fresh or frozen are always going to be our best options for that. The least processed, the better. So if you want an apple, you want it to look like an apple and not be an apple-flavored product, for example. Now, the dietitian's part of your healthcare team, and they're there to support you and help you individualize your plan. As you go through treatment, your diet can change just based on any side effects that you may experience or any specific needs that you may have. Some side effects can include things like poor appetite, maybe nausea, vomiting, potentially diarrhea or fatigue. If you're not able to meet your nutrition needs, it may result in a delay in treatment. The dietitian can help you adjust based on what you're going through and help you find ways to make it work for where you are in your treatment. Even if you're overweight, you can still become malnourished. A lot of people think, oh, I have weight to lose, I don't need to worry about it. And the thing is that weight, unfortunately, isn't how we determine nourishment. There are a lot of other ways that we look at nourishment that don't just look at weight. When you are malnourished, it can increase things like fatigue and make you feel like you just don't have the energy to do the things that you want to do, because oftentimes when you're not eating enough, you could be losing some muscle, and that can really impact your energy level. There are medications to help with side effects, and so being understanding of how to take those medications, when to take them, is very important, so make sure you talk with your team. Hydration is something we oftentimes forget, and hydration fluids or anything that's liquid at room temperature, so things like water, milk, juice, for example. A general guideline is we need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day, and some treatments may require that you increase your fluid intake or decrease it. So talk with your healthcare team to understand your unique needs. I'm going to close with that and hand the line back over to Carolyn. Thank you for letting me be part of today's presentation.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was such a wonderful presentation. Really lots of wonderful information about foods and nutrition and hydration tips that people should really keep in mind all the time. So thank you so much. Very excellent presentation, just stellar. And our next speaker is Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell. And Dr. O'Donnell is Clinical Director of Early Detection and Prevention of Cancer, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. O'Donnell will be addressing lifestyle, physical activity, and balance concerns with practical tips, guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, follow-up care, quality of life concerns, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. O'Donnell.
Thank you very much for the warm welcome, and it's my true privilege and pleasure to be able to talk to you about a number of topics that face patients with multiple myeloma. One of the most important considerations is quality of life and the preservation of quality of life, and if there are symptoms related to multiple myeloma, making those symptoms better. And so I've been asked today to talk a little bit about physical activity. Physical activity is really important for preservation of our health, for mood, for well-being, for functioning, and for being able to do just our basic activities of daily living. But in patients with myeloma, sometimes there are complications with the bones or challenges that make this a little more difficult. So the most important thing when we think about exercise and activity is, you know, first talking with your physician to make sure there aren't any specific types of activities that need to be avoided. But I think, you know, one of the most important take-home messages is to try and always remain active. There's a tendency when someone has a new cancer diagnosis to try and take over doing things for them and help them. And I would argue that it's really important to stay engaged, to stay active, to keep doing those activities of daily living that you're currently doing so that you don't lose that function. It's a little bit like use it or lose it. And there are a lot of things that you can do that are not like going for a run or you know, hiking a mountain. There are gentle things you can do, easy things, just like turning on the music and moving around your house or dancing. They feel good. They're good for your mood. And, you know, doing things like yoga, or non-weight bearing activities like an exercise bicycle or all types of options that might be appropriate once you've talked to your doctor. But I think the most important thing is trying to limit sedentary time. And so if you're taking a phone call or, you know, if you're watching something on your tablet or your phone, get up and move around if you can and try not to stay sedentary. And that, too, will help you preserve your function. One of the other things that we often talk about is how to optimize your care with your providers. And so communication is critical. And if you have something that is impairing your quality of life, whether it's insomnia from the steroids that you're taking as part of your treatment, they're keeping you up all night, and then you're coming crashing down 3 days later, it's really important to write these things down and bring them to your appointment with your doctor, so that the team knows what's going on, because we can make adjustments to those medicines, particularly things like the dexamethasone, that may help your quality of life and improve your overall experience, because treatment for myeloma is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And when we start out the therapy, it's really like putting on a one-size-fits-all suit, and now we need to tailor it to you. And the way that we can tailor it is through good communication. Your team really wants to know what's going on with you. We want to hear about your symptoms. So don't ever hesitate to bring them forward, share them with the doctor, share them with the nurse, so that we can really custom fit the suit to you so that you'll have the best possible experience with your treatment as you go through with multiple myeloma. If you do have virtual appointments, it's fine to bring another family member to those as well. With any of these appointments, either make a note, write it down, carry it in, you know, with you to the appointment, or put it in your phone too. Most of us use smartphones, and make a list because we've all had the experience where we walk out of the appointment and we're like, oh, I forgot to ask them something. So make that part of your routine, where the minute you get seated in the office, you pull up that list and you wait for the provider to come in, so that you can go through everything that's transpired since you were last seen and make sure, you know, that your needs are met, because at the end of the day, it's a partnership, and that's really what your team wants. And so I really appreciate the time I've been given to speak about lifestyle and quality of life, and thank you very much for including me.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. O'Donnell. That was just a stellar presentation with a lot of information, particularly about balance and activity, lose it or either use it or lose it, and basically reminding everyone the importance of really staying active with consulting your doctor, and also the guidelines for the telehealth visits. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Sarah Grisales-Yaramello, and she is an oncology social worker. She's our Insights and Call Center Program Manager at Cancer Care. And Ms. Jarmello will present how to cope with health care disparities and how telehealth may help in advancing your health equity, Cancer Care's free programs and services, and Cancer Care's Hope Line. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Jarmello.
Thank you so much for the introduction, Carolyn, and for having me be a part of this program. As Dr. Cole mentioned earlier, multiple myeloma disproportionately affects Black, African American, and Latino patients who often face delays in diagnoses and limited access to advanced treatment. It is important to note that despite the barriers, there are different ways that you can navigate them to facilitate better outcomes within your cancer journey. Educating yourself about multiple myeloma is an essential tool in addressing disparities. Because multiple myeloma is rare and a complex blood cancer, understanding the diagnosis fully, the treatment options, and potential complications is crucial. The knowledge empowers you to ask the right questions to your medical team and spot when something doesn't feel right within your care. working with a myeloma specialist can also be beneficial. Not all oncologists specialize in multiple myeloma, so seeking a myeloma expert, even if it's via telehealth, can help you identify adequate care for you. Many major cancer centers also offer virtual second opinions for multiple myeloma, so be sure to research major cancer centers in your nearby area. Addressing racial and socioeconomic disparities is also crucial, as this factor may also be impacting access to the latest treatments or accessing a care team that displays cultural humility. Though it can be difficult to do so, if you feel discriminated against, dismissed, or not taken seriously, it is important to seek a second opinion. It is important to also acknowledge that bias and systemic inequities exist. Look for care teams with diverse staff or that's willing to understand your social identity. Leaning on support systems can also be a help in addressing disparities. It is crucial to know that you're not alone. Use patient navigators, social workers, or faith-based support systems that can help you with emotional support, case management, and they could also help you connect to patient assistance programs, clinical trials, and nonprofit supportive organizations that can provide comprehensive services that may address emotional and financial concerns. Telehealth can also help in addressing disparities, and they can help by providing remote access to multiple myeloma specialists. The telehealth can connect patients in rural or underserved areas with major cancer centers. As mentioned earlier, even if it's if in-person travel is not feasible, video visits may allow ongoing care from multiple myeloma experts. Telehealth can also be useful in symptom management and side effect monitoring. So regular telehealth check-ins can help manage side effects quickly without unnecessary ER visits, and they could also help assist with addressing appointments for side effects like bone pain, fatigue, and it can use to discuss results after blood work or bone marrow tests and adjust treatment without needing full clinic visits. Telehealth can also open the door for education and caregiver support. So there could be telehealth sessions that can include family members, caregivers, providing shared education on multiple myeloma management, medications, and home care strategies. Healthcare disparities are real, but you don't have to navigate them alone. Telehealth is not just convenient, but it's potentially life-saving when it helps you access better care, earlier interventions, and ongoing support. There's also plenty of national organizations that provide psychosocial supportive services, Cancer Care being one of them, which is the leading national organization providing free professional supportive services and information to help people manage emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups over the phone, online, and in person, educational workshops, publications, and financial and copay assistance. All of these cancer care services are provided by master's prepared oncology social workers and world-leading cancer experts. To access our services, you may call our helpline, and our number is 1-800-813-4673, or you can also access our website, which is cancercare.org. We also have a program regarding clinical trials, which is called My Trialist, and this program can help you connect you to support and education about clinical trials. Thank you so much again for having me.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Caramello. That was just a superb presentation and just so much information for our participants. Very stellar, and I know there'll be lots of questions to you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And now we're going to go right on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Kath to explain to you how to queue up and ask questions online.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay. This is a question for Dr. Carl. Are clinical trials shifting to focus on populations that face the highest disease burden?
Yeah, that's my mom was a elementary school principle. So every question is a great question. So I'm going to say that over and over again. But that's a really good question. And the answer is yes, that they're really, you know, traditionally the clinical trials have been conducted at some of the you know, big cancer centers, and have really, because of all the access problems we've talked about, there's been, you know, difficulty in accessing those centers, therefore difficulty accessing the trials. And some of the ways that the trials are written have a built-in bias that have excluded diverse populations. And so right now, in fact, I've done probably more talks about diversifying clinical trials now than I ever have in my career. Now, not only is industry much more motivated to get diverse populations in clinical trials, but also institutions and the FDA have all prioritized having diverse populations in clinical trials. Clinical trials have been now rewritten in order to make it more accessible by decentralizing them away from the big centers into communities that we have not deployed clinical trials in before. And I think most importantly, there's been a cultural change that we now, as a myeloma community, we now see the importance of making sure that we eliminate a lot of the disparities that we talked about earlier, including getting, you know, diverse populations based on race, ethnicity, age, gender, socioeconomic status, a rural or urban, to make sure that all those patients have access to clinical trials so they can all benefit from kind of the fantastic things that are happening in the field.
Thank you so much. And another question for you, Dr. Cole. What are the factors that increase risk of kidney disease in multiple myeloma patients?
Again, a super good question. The biggest thing is the type of myeloma. That there, in general, you know, three types of myeloma based on the protein they express. So one thing that myeloma does is it produces protein. These plasma cells normally produce antibodies, but when they become cancerous, they produce excessive amounts of blood plasma or antibodies that can be detected in the blood. If those are intact proteins, the IgG, IgA, sometimes IgD, those proteins are too big to get stuck in the kidneys. But if the myeloma is producing light chains, which are fragments of protein, and about 20% of myeloma patients will produce it, then those light chains can get deposit in the kidneys, causing kidney damage. So it's the type of myeloma. Patients that have light chain myeloma, usually a kappa or lambda, the two types of light chains, they have a higher risk of having kidney disease. Also, and it's really important, as I mentioned earlier, to stay well hydrated with this disease. That one thing that can decrease the kidney function when people are getting some of these medications is dehydration. And so, you know, flushing out the kidneys, you know, while people are receiving therapy, staying well hydrated is really important to maintaining kidney health with multiple myeloma.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Mr. Armello. Do you know of any resources that promote patient advocacy to address health disparities? I would like to pass on any education resources to my parents.
Sure, absolutely. So I definitely encourage you to give us a call on our helpline, our 1-800 number. We provide a bunch of resources depending on the specific barriers that your mom is facing. You can be connected to a social worker, and then when you share these barriers, we provide some resources specifically tailored to those barriers that you and your mom are experiencing. There's other national organizations that can also provide support if you're looking for financial assistance. So I would definitely encourage you to give us a call at Cancer Care, but also look into blood cancer organizations or multiple myeloma specific cancer organizations that could also provide the with tailored support.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And also a question about our clinical trial shift. Oh, no, we already took that question. Sorry. We already did that one. So this would be a question for Ms. Jaramillo. Are patient navigators commonly a part of care of the care team? Or if I don't have one, who on the care team should I ask about working with one?
Sure, that is an excellent question. So this honestly depends on the hospital or treatment center that you're going to. Sometimes there's patient navigators, other times there's social workers, hospital social workers, sometimes there's both. If you're not already connected to a social worker, I would definitely encourage you to inquire with your oncologist if you feel comfortable, and they can guide you to or connect you to somebody who can provide you with these services. Or, you know, you could ask anyone in your care team if you have an oncology nurse. Right, if you're experiencing some barriers, it's always recommended to share with the type of barriers that you're experiencing with your medical team, so your oncologist, your nurse. That way they can support you and guide you to the right direction, because they may not be able to directly address some of those barriers, but they can definitely connect you to support. So communicating with your healthcare team, anyone in your team, can really help you find guidance, specifically with a patient navigator. If you live in a more rural area, it might be a little bit more difficult. I do know that if there aren't any patient navigators or hospital social workers, sometimes there's something called a financial navigator, some type of navigator. They may have different names. So I would say it's good to keep that in mind as well, that it might not be called a patient navigator, but they may have the same function.
Excellent. Thank you so much. It's really important to keep that in mind for everybody. And then a question for Dr. Cole. Can you discuss how not having access to continued care impacts health outcomes?
Yes. So, you know, one thing that I had kind of mentioned earlier, and that is an important part of myeloma care, is maintenance therapy. That we learned years ago that, you know, one thing that is important in keeping patients in their responses and remissions is ongoing therapy. That especially when patients either at the time of diagnosis or after their induction therapy or after their transplant or after they relapse, that myeloma patients are on some continuous therapy, with the exception of sometimes getting the T-cell redirection therapies. And continuing that can be a challenge, that if patients, you know, get lost to follow-up, or they don't see their doctors, or their doctors forget to write their prescriptions for their maintenance therapy, then there can be lapses in care. And if a patient, you know, stops their maintenance therapy, then their disease could relapse. And so, you know, making sure, you know, sometimes, you know, the computer systems, you know, forget to schedule a follow-up appointment. And if you don't have a follow-up appointment with your doctor, you know, make sure that you have it. Make sure that you stay in touch, because just like was mentioned earlier, myeloma isn't a sprint. It's a longer haul, and making sure that you're, you know, in contact with your physician and care team, and making sure that there aren't any lapses of care, because those lapses of care can cause the disease to return.
Excellent. And then a question also for you, Dr. Cole. Where can I find more resources on clinical trials?
Yes, and so, you know, the blanket answer is, you know, clinicaltrials.gov. But just, you know, Sarah had mentioned earlier that a lot of the myeloma support groups, the International Myeloma Foundation, the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, the health tree for myeloma all have both operators, and they have search engines to help find clinical trials. And these days, especially when they're myeloma focused, can really help narrow down, you know, within your area, within your zip code of where there are clinical trials for myeloma and what stage. Because I think one important thing to know about myeloma clinical trials is that we have clinical trials for every stage of the disease. Clinical trials just isn't for patients that have, you know, have really bad disease and have gone through multiple therapies. We have clinical trials for precursor diseases, for MGUS, for smoldering myeloma, for newly diagnosed, for post-transplant, for, you know, every phase of disease, there are clinical trials available. And those clinical trials really do contain, you know, the standard of care, because clinical trials in myeloma is very competitive. So only the best clinical trials really meet the muster of being out in the public domain. And so, you know, seeking out clinical trials not only benefits the myeloma community and other patients, but can also benefit you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Ms. Harrell, do you also want to talk about the trial list that Kids Care offers as well?
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. So Cancer Care has a partnership, and we have a specific support for those who are looking for more education about clinical trials. We have a website. The website is called mytriallist.org, and this website can provide information about clinical trials, so what clinical trials are, frequently asked questions. There's also patient testimonials, so patients really sharing their journey on what led them to take a clinical trial, what their process was like. And then there's also a search engine that can help you search clinical trials. You can put your zip code or your address, the type of trial that you're looking for, and then the search engine will generate some answers with the nearby clinical trials. And it has the eligibility criteria as well as detailed information about the clinical trial. And folks can also call our helpline and be connected to a specialist that can help answer questions about clinical trials and how to enroll in a clinical trial or how to navigate it, per se.
Thank you. Well, this has been a phenomenal call, I must say. Although we've done this program before, I have to say this is probably the best ever. Both the questions were terrific, and, of course, our speakers were incredible as well. It was just a great call today, just phenomenal call, probably the best ever we've done. And we will be doing other programs like this, so please stay tuned. But I do want to comment on, for those of you, we weren't able to take everyone's questions, so we took a lot of questions, but we weren't able to take everyone's. And I also do want to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway from today's program. So I'm going to start with Dr. Cole, if you would just give a takeaway from today's program.
Yeah, I've been doing this for about 20 years, and I've been really focusing on healthcare disparities over the past 10 years. And there's really been a remarkable evolution, not only in myeloma, but in addressing the healthcare disparities. 10 years ago, when I mentioned some of these disparities, people looked at me kind of sideways and said, you know, it's not a priority. And now across the myeloma community, patients, physicians, researchers, industry, FDA, everyone is really working to try and eliminate some of the healthcare disparities. And we're really working to cure myeloma. And so I would say, you know, my big takeaway is that there's so much hope for this disease for the future. I am very appreciative for the audience and listening in today. And I hope that you can see that there are a lot of solutions to a lot of the problems, and there's hope for the future.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Cole. That was wonderful. And Ms. Yarmello.
Yeah, thank you so much for this presentation, Carolyn. And one of my big takeaways is that
Multiple myeloma can be challenging, especially for underserved communities, but you don't have to face it alone. Educating yourself, connecting with a multiple myeloma specialist, even if it's through telehealth and leaning on support systems, can make a big difference. Disparities in care are also real, and there are tools and resources to help you get the care that you deserve. Knowledge, advocacy, and support can lead to better outcomes because your life and health matters.
Thank you so much. I want to thank our speakers. Again, you've been phenomenal. I want to thank all the participants who asked such great questions. And I do want to comment on, we couldn't take everyone's question because there were so many of you on the call today, so I want to comment on that. For those of you who had a chance to ask a question, I do encourage you to take your question and ask your healthcare team the same question, because you've learned a lot today. And so take it back to your healthcare team and you know, ask them the same question. That's really important. And then for those of you who are in queue and didn't get to ask your question, take your question to your healthcare team. Again, you've learned a lot, and you'll probably be able to ask your question in a more informed way, and you'll probably be able to understand more what your speakers are, what your physicians are saying to you. And also, before I conclude, and I want to repeat that we don't want anyone to feel alone in coping with multiple myeloma. We want you to know that you're now part of a community of support, and we are here to help you, both cancer care. And we will be providing a SurveyMonkey evaluation at the end of today's, well, probably in about a week from today's program. And in that evaluation, there's an evaluation of the program, but we also provide all the resources that we mentioned, even some that we may not have mentioned, so you'll have access to many more resources as well. And however, I do want to comment on one thing. For those of you who you know, who may not have had a chance to ask your question, as well as those who have asked a question, please go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your questions and keep asking your questions. That's really important. That's how you'll learn over and over again, you know, the answers to your questions. Also, we have discovered that all of our participants on these calls have difficulty reaching their healthcare team, not during the day, but evenings, weekends, and holidays. So please always check with your healthcare team what number to call evenings, weekends, and holidays. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.